Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, we'll speak with Wright State University Professor of Philosophy, William Irvin. His latest book is about the culture of insults. Community Voices producer Lauren Schaus will tell us about Beaver Creek's upcoming Art in the Park. And later in the program, we've got Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. Up first, a well-known artist and pioneer of Wright State University's film and video department died this week. Judd Yalka was born in New York City in 1938, but has been a Dayton resident since 1973. He was an assistant professor of art at Wright State. Yalka also taught at Sinclair Community College and Xavier University in Cincinnati. As an artist, Yalka was the recipient of numerous fellowships and grants from the Ohio Arts Council, the New York State Council on the Arts, the Montgomery County Arts and Cultural District. Eva Buttacavoli with the Dayton Visual Arts Center says Yalcutt's resume and achievements were expansive.
In New York in 1959, at 21, he was a film buff, and he hung out with the experimental filmmakers Namjoon Paik, Trisha Brown, Yayoi Kusama. He worked with holograms later in his life, and he worked with this thing called the prexilloscope, which was a type of movie machine that projected images kind of into the air onto a screen, like an oscilloscope. Last year, he had an exhibition at University of Dayton. He also was part of an exhibition at the Whitney Museum, the Pompidou in Paris, all last year. So we're all reeling from this.
But Buttacavoli also believes that Yalcutt's appeal was in his mastery of different mediums and in his personality.
Not only was he a great man in the Dayton art and film world, but he experimented with all sorts of medium. He also worked in collage. He was a prolific writer. He was a character. He was a crazy cool cat, a real rock star of his generation.
Some of Yalcutt's artwork is currently on display at the Dayton Visual Arts Center. The artist died on Tuesday. He was 75 years old. A pro-gun group in Ohio has raised more than $12,000 to buy George Zimmerman a new firearm. He is the former Neighborhood Watch volunteer who was acquitted of all charges in the fatal killing of the unarmed teen Trayvon Martin in Florida. Buckeye Firearms Foundation spokesperson Jim Irvine says his group raised money because they believe Zimmerman's gun owner rights are being violated. The foundation posted a story on their website after the Justice Department ordered the Sanford Police Department to keep George Zimmerman's gun and other objects pending their investigation into civil rights violations in the case. The site brought in more than $12,000 from 48 states and three countries, and Irvine says the check was delivered to Zimmerman on Tuesday.
Because we want to help somebody who needs help, is the bottom line. And when the Department of Justice said we're going to put a hold on all his property after he's acquitted and not return his stuff to him, we said, man, that stinks. This guy's in a bad spot. So we just thought, you know what, let's just raise a little money and help him out.
Irvine says because of their support, their website has been hacked and taken offline. The Buckeye Firearms Foundation is working with the FBI to find out who is responsible. The Senate passed a bill this week that will lower student loan interest rates, at least for a few years. Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown isn't happy with the legislation. This week, he spoke to WISO News Director Emily McCord.
The president's called this a victory for the nation's students, but you don't like this legislation. Why not?
Yeah, it's a good thing for students for a couple, 3 years, but as you suggested, Emily, the interest rates will, almost as the economy improves, almost certainly will go up. We've had historically low interest rates. They started to go up recently. They're almost certain that they will. And in the end, the government will be profiting to the tune of tens and tens of billions of dollars from these student loans at the expense on the backs of America's college community college and four-year schools and tech schools and all that. And that's not how we should run this program. It shouldn't be a profit center for the government. It should be a way of providing access for young people to go on to school.
Now, this point, this idea of the government profiting off students, that to some extent can be disputed because of the way that those numbers are accounted for.
Well, most fair-minded economists and observers of this, including a number of people supporting the bill, acknowledge that the government will, in fact, profit to the tune of tens of billions of dollars from these student loans. People are graduating with huge student debt now that simply didn't happen a generation or two ago. The average student loan debt for those who have debt is $30,000+, and that's just not fair to this next generation. This bill will, I think, only make it worse.
But isn't it better than nothing?
Well, it's better than nothing, of course, but I don't think nothing should be the alternative. We had frozen interest rates at 3.4. We should have extended it one more year while we work out a whole host of issues here. It's not just interest rates. It's not just availability of Pell Grants, although that's really important. And I want to see that any money the government makes circulating back into Pell Grants. But it's also how do we stabilize costs of college and universities. We know that nothing's gone up in the past 30 years. Even health care to the same percentage, the same rate in terms of cost to the American public as has college education. And, you know, you can go to Sinclair, you can go to Cincinnati State. It's less expensive. You can get great education. But all schools are more expensive and far too expensive. And increasingly out of reach. I mean, I hear stories of young people that think, working class kids, I don't think I'm going on to school, even though I want to. I don't think I, because my parents can't afford it, and I don't want to take on this huge debt. And what kind of message does that send, and what kind of future does that bring us?
So this is, at least for now, a good deal for students. Are you going to be pushing other plans as we move forward?
Yeah, we're going to continue to work on this. This is not the last of the last year. I mean, I assume this bill will become law. House will pass it. President will sign it. I don't think it's a tragedy. I think it's a lost opportunity. It's as you say, it's good for them for 3 years, but longer term, it's going to mean significantly, almost certainly going to mean significantly higher interest rates for these students that as these loans as they move on in their lives. By the year 2017, the rates would more than double from what they were last year and likely continue to go up. So we're very concerned about where this goes.
You know, to some extent, though, the idea that the economy is getting better, doesn't that mean that we should be able to afford more of our share of the interest here?
Well, it doesn't mean that a student who graduates from Cincinnati State with debt of $22,000, or a student graduating from UC or a Wright State or Central State with a debt of $40,000, or from a private school like UD or Xavier with a debt of maybe $100,000, that it still is an oppressive debt on them as they get out of college or out of community college or a 4-year school, and it means they're not buying a house in many cases. They're not starting a business. They're not doing, maybe not getting married as soon. They're not doing the things, starting a family, that we want them to do for their own fulfillment and also for this economy. So even as the economy gets better, jobs are more plentiful for college graduates. We're not seeing higher pay in these jobs mostly. We're seeing sort of a flat. Most of America hasn't had a raise in a decade. And to put this extra burden on these students is it's just unfair.
I've been speaking with Senator Sherrod Brown. Thanks for being here today.
Glad to be with you. Thanks, Emily.
Hey, stop! Little girl, stop! Look, I need to bore you. Hoverboard.
Well, it's not the super cool hoverboard that Marty McFly rode on in Back to the Future 2, but yesterday, Springfield's Windy Knoll Golf Club unveiled the world's first hovercraft golf cart. The golf club is the first in the country to make the hovercraft available for public use. WYSO's Wayne Baker reports.
That's the sound of the Neoteric Golf Hovercraft's 65-horsepower German engine that will soon be carting golfers and their bags through water hazards and sand traps at the Windy Knoll Golf Club. It looks like a water ride at an amusement park attached to a wind fan. It travels 9 inches off the ground, and it's fast, 55 miles per hour at top speed. They cost $58,000 apiece, and the golf course purchased two of them. Pete Duffy is the managing director at Windy Knoll. He says the hovercraft is worth the investment.
It spreads the word about our public golf course. It's a whole new concept that anybody that's been around golf has never had to wrap their mind around.
Golfing pro Bubba Watson helped design the hovercraft. Back in April, he put a video of the space-age-looking vehicle cruising around a golf course on YouTube. It went viral and caught the eyes of Duffy and his father, Dave.
Just seeing it from the few streets that we have bordering us, when you're flying down the fairway or something, people won't know what it is, so it will generate some curiosity, and hopefully people will at least stop in and see what we're about.
Pete Duffy says there is a special price to use the hovercraft, but it won't raise fees for other patrons. Saturday night's unveiling will feature Hall of Famer Nancy Lopez, current LPGA Tour player Paige McKenzie, and the Golf Channel's Tim Rosefort. For WISO, I'm Wayne Baker reporting.
While a lot of kids are holding on to that last few weeks of sweet freedom before school starts, 12-year-old Beaver Creek resident Evelyn Long is spending her free hours creating and organizing a community event, Beaver Creek's Art in the Park, a celebration of the local art scene. Community Voices producer Lauren Schaus reports.
Right now, we are looking at the lake where we will be having the art walk around, where you can meet artists, and anybody that comes really will be able to put art up.
Although Evelyn Long has more than enough on her docket this summer, she took some time out to show me around Dominic Lofino Park in Beaver Creek and talk about what she's got planned there for Beaver Creek's Art in the Park.
And we are also looking at a little pavilion where the Community Canvas Art Project will be, where anybody who comes to the event can paint whatever and just kind of let their artistic abilities out.
Artists will show their work along a walkway that encircles the park's lake, where event-goers can stroll and browse. The event will also feature activities for kids near the park's playground, with crafts and musical instruments to try out. Evelyn is a Girl Scout cadet, and her idea for the project sprang from a desire to earn the prestigious Silver Award, the highest honor for a Girl Scout cadet. To earn the award, cadets create a project that addresses a community need and creates positive change. Evelyn says it wasn't hard for her to spot a place in Beaver Creek where she could create such a change.
My mom, actually, she majored in art in college, so I've always had, like, a very artistic childhood. I'm always just kind of, I don't want to say complaining, but I'm always concerned about the artistic level that we have in Beaver Creek, because we live around Kettering and all these places and Yellow Springs that have a lot of art community, and we really don't have that here.
Evelyn's put in a lot of hard work on the project and has also marshaled the help of her mom, Rain Turner, in putting things together.
Well, I do what Evie tells me, so she put me in charge of digging up some sponsors and press releases to get the word out online, to build a Facebook and all that kind of thing. But she approves every email, everything that goes out goes by her.
Aside from her mom, Evelyn's gotten support from her community, including volunteers from her Girl Scout troop, and sponsorship and promotion from Decoy Arts Studio. Evelyn also put herself to work raising funds for the event by serving pizza at the Beaver Creek Pizza Dive, who donated profits from sales at their pizza buffet to the art walk. Mom Rain says she had no doubt that Evelyn had more than enough tenacity to pull off a project like this.
It's a big endeavor, but she is a very headstrong, ambitious girl, so I knew she could do it if she put her mind to it and if she had some help from the community, which has been very responsive.
Evelyn doesn't deny that her ambitious nature made her a natural for this project.
I try to do things bigger and better and first. I actually have, like, a 10-year plan. I want to be, like, the director of communications for Disney in Celebration, Florida. Like, I know everything I want to do.
Yeah, I don't know what I'm doing next year, but she knows what she's doing 10 years from now.
Evelyn says her whole family is proud of her for successfully bringing her dedication to Girl Scouts together with her love of art and community. But aside from these things, Evelyn says she had one more motivation for the project, which involves that 10-year plan she mentioned.
I know that this will look awesome on my application. I do love art, but I love Disney a little bit more, so I'm pretty excited for that one, actually.
For WYSO, I'm Lauren Schaus.
Beaver Creek's Art in the Park kicks off at noon on Sunday, August 3rd at Dominic Lofino Park in Beaver Creek. You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us. Today, joining me on the phone, Professor of Philosophy at Wright State University, William Irvin. He is the author of a new book called A Slap in the Face, Why Insults Hurt and Why They Shouldn't. William, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for asking me, Jerry.
I want to start with the premise. In your words, someone can, with 10 words spoken in 10 seconds, destroy a relationship that's lasted for 10 years. Let's talk about that.
Insults are very powerful things, and we care very much about them. I argue in the book that it's because of our evolutionary past, and as a result, they play a very important role in all of our social interactions. And it's also amazing the number of ways in which you can insult someone. You can insult someone in the act of trying to compliment them if it isn't the compliment they wanted. You can insult someone by doing nothing at all, for instance, failing to thank someone. And the more I did research on this, the more I became amazed by the role that these insults play.
And where did your interest in this begin?
My previous book was on Stoic philosophy, and I found that the Stoic philosophers of ancient Greece and Rome spent an inordinate amount of time thinking about insults and how best to defend ourselves from them. At first, I thought that was a very curious thing for philosophers to be doing, but then I realized it made perfect sense if our goal is to have good days, a life composed of good days. Because one of the things that disrupts our tranquility is the intended and unintended insults of other people.
I would think the unintended are just as painful.
They can actually be more painful. An example of this is a backhanded praise, backhanded compliment. You know, somebody says to you, "I don't care what anyone says, you're not stupid." Well, they're defending you, but in a way, you didn't want to be defended because they're also revealing to you something that you might find to be quite painful. And, of course, you know, there are major insults if someone extends a hand to shake your hand and you don't extend yours back. You've done nothing at all, and that's the problem.
It's been noted that you are a collector of insults, and is this a recent evolution in your life, or did that start with the previous book?
Oh, it's a recent thing. So when I took an interest in insults, I checked out every insult book I could get. But I always have to explain to people that this is a book about insults. It's not a book of insults. Although when I get a chance, I'm not above including some of the juicy insults I found in my research.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that research. I'm interested in some of the cultures or periods of time that involved insults into their language, into their way of life or their communications.
As far as I can tell, as long as there have been written communications, there have been insults. You can find insults in the Old Testament of the Bible. You can find insults in the graffiti, of the walls of ancient villages. And it's likely that before there were words, there were verbal insults as well. And, you know, if you go back in human history, there was a time before even words, I suppose, even spoken words, at which point we would have simply done what animals did. We would have threatened each other, made threatening noises, or engaged in physical insults of various kinds.
You've called the Elizabethan period the Golden Age of Insults. Can you elaborate more on that?
Well, they just have such spectacularly verbal insults. In modern times, we've gotten away from that, and many people think that to simply flip someone an obscene gesture or drop the F-bomb, that counts as an insult. And, of course, compared to what Shakespeare was capable of, that's nothing. That's child's play. It's almost inarticulate in comparison. So if you like the use of words, the clever use of words, Shakespeare is the place to look.
Can you expound a little bit more on that?
Yeah, insults. It's really interesting. People, for instance, in politics, political discourse tends to be full of insults. Candidates will insult the other candidate. People will insult the person, the candidate they aren't voting for. And then the question is, why this reliance on insults? I think it's because people don't like to think. And a clever insult of someone, a laughable insult of someone, gives them an excuse to stop thinking and just act on whatever the impulse they have is. So, you know, in the same way as our political discourse tends not to be reasoned these days, it has, to some extent, been taken over simply by character attacks, which are coupled with insults. And that's unfortunate, I think.
And that's actually quite a statement. It's certainly not a media that's helping that situation.
Oh, no. You know, the media often compounds it, coming up with clever things to say, but that are clever in one sense, but of course aren't deep or profound. It's unfortunate. It really is. Because, you know, the political choices we make have major consequences in our lives and the lives of our kids, and it shouldn't be settled by who can unleash the best insult.
The thesis of your book, and in fact right in the title, Why Insults Hurt and Why They Shouldn't, you actually are looking for a solution to where we have gotten to this point.
Right. So we, for kind of evolutionary historical reasons, are very, very much concerned with our social status. And that's almost a sure recipe to an unpleasant life. You should care very much what some people think about you. You should go out of your way to seek mentors and role models, and you should listen when they're critical of you, because that's why you choose them. But there are any number of other people who insult you for a variety of reasons. They feel challenged by the values you've adopted. Sometimes they lash out at you for a number of kind of emotional reasons. So you can either spend your life in turmoil over that aspect of your social life, or you can do your best to tune it out and realize that there are going to be people with different values. They are going to be challenged by your own values. The best way to respond is not to respond at all.
Well, I imagine that you're talking about the more optimistic person that can do that with a little more ease than who you talk about in your book, people who may be hypersensitive to insults or people with low self-esteem.
Right, and those are people who will really feel the sting of the insults. So to improve one's self-esteem is a wonderful thing, but I also argue in the book that the American obsession with self-esteem improvement, you know, in the 1980s, 1990s, has backfired hugely, because instead of making people secure against insults, has had the tendency of making people hypersensitive to those same insults. And as a result, a few words can do much more damage than was otherwise the case.
Let's talk about dismissive responses, which you talk about in the book. Those could actually be very effective for making the insulter feeling somewhat insulted themselves.
Yeah, you know, the one leading response is no response at all, and I've done this as part of the research for the book. You know, when insulted, I tried different techniques to just carry on with the conversation as if nothing has happened. Will really leave your insulter unsure of what to do. I mean, the person will wonder maybe you didn't hear the insult. If they repeat the insult, then you can say, well, I heard it the first time, and then just carry on. It's the last thing they expect, living as they do in a culture in which people respond to insults with insults. And also notice that to respond, to adopt that kind of insult pacifism, you don't have to be witty at all. You simply say nothing, and it's singularly effective at the same time. So it's actually the one that the ancient Stoics, one of their favored ways of responding. And I've checked it out. It seems to still work.
In your book, you talk about the craving for social status, and you refer to it as a game of hierarchy.
Yeah, so when we're put in social context, of kind of natural inclination is to try to rise in the social hierarchy of that group. And one way you can accomplish that is by broadcasting your own achievements to let people know what a wonderful human being you are, and then to denigrate their achievements through, hopefully, through subtle insults. It's a game that gets played a lot, and it's a game that's likely to make those who play it miserable in some aspects of their lives. So one of the things I argue for in the book is simply dropping out of that game, refusing to play that game. It takes work because you have to overcome the evolutionary programming that makes you care what even complete strangers think about you. But I think with a conscious effort, a progress can be made in that direction.
We've talked about people with low self-esteem and how they might be more susceptible to insults, but you also talk about intelligent, educated people who, by all means, should have great self-esteem, who also may still feel the need to insult.
It's true. It's a very difficult habit to overcome. So I talk at one point in the book about the kinds of insults you can expect PhDs and universities to inflict on each other. I've seen that and participated in that. And, it's a standard thing. We just want people to recognize, to admire. And when we feel that there isn't sufficient admiration, we react in a variety of ways, not all of which are perfectly rational, despite our advanced education. But there you have it. You know, we're still humans deep down.
And so don't you think this is really a matter of respect for ourselves and respect of others?
Sure. You should respect others. You should be kind to others. You will benefit enormously from your acts of kindness to others. But we all have lurking in us this impish voice in our head that when we feel slighted, demands that we respond, hopefully verbally, so we don't end up getting arrested. And the voice is not a good voice to pay attention to. It's a voice that you should try to stifle. You know, we're full of these little voices that try to get us to do things that we shouldn't be doing, you know, that try to prompt us on. And one of the things of becoming a thoughtful, civilized human being is to overcome the role we allow those voices to have. And that was the advice of the Stoic philosophers once again. And, you know, I'm in great admiration of them and their advice.
Any final comments on your book? How's the response?
Good response. And it's interesting now. It's just been released on the British market, the Oxford University Press, and they publish worldwide. And so apparently some of the British newspapers have been having fun at my expense, which is fine by me. And I realized that one of the things I did is I insulted book reviewers in the book, which probably in retrospect wasn't the most strategic thing to have done, given that the book itself would someday be reviewed. So.
And so what's next for you?
I'm currently under contract with Oxford to write a book on moments of inspiration and the social consequences of those moments. So it's a dramatically different thing to be doing. But what I do is I follow my curiosity where it leads me, and then I try to write a book reporting my discoveries.
I've been speaking with William Irvin, author of A Slap in the Face, Why Insults Hurt and Why They Shouldn't. William, thanks so much for your time today.
Oh, thank you, Jerry.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the sixth week of middle summer. The trajectory of August and the transition to late summer are made up of interlocking associations. Some of these connections are used by farmers and gardeners, and others are tools for awareness of how the world fits together. Throughout the month ahead, when spiders start to increase their building of webs in the woodlot, then the yellowjacket season begins in the windfalled apples and the plums, and then morning fogs increase in the valleys. When the lilies are gone, summer stabilizes in the golden purple coneflowers, the tall wingstem and ironweed, and the rich opening of ragweed, the green budding stalks of the goldenrod poised, their full season still ahead. When black walnut trees have lost about a third of their leaves, then hummingbirds and wood ducks and Baltimore orioles and purple martins start to disappear south. When cardinals stop singing before dawn, then the soybean leaves are yellowing in the fields and farmers start to cut corn for silage. When long flocks of blackbirds move across the sky, then it's time for plums to be the sweetest of the year. When all the summer apples have been picked, then the first puffball mushroom of the year swells in the cool, damp night. When there's more than one Judas maple tree in the woodlot, then hickory nutting season is underway. And when the last of the garden flocks die back, then ragweed time winds down, and the year's final tier of wildflowers is budding, the beggar ticks and the burr marigolds, the asters and the zigzag goldenrod. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the first week of late summer. In the meantime, watch and see how, when one thing is happening, something else is happening too. There's always a connection. There's always a fitting together.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at WYSO.org.
That's it for this edition of WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at WYSO.org. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks to all our listeners, and thank you for listening to WYSO, a community service of Antioch College for the Miami Valley and beyond. Coming up next, the Book Nook.